drought hits Central and South American countries. Meanwhile, Dubai gets 2 years of rain in one day.
There was one point at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon where the cloud cover was so thick, it literally felt like nighttime.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Also today, a historic land victory for the Haida Nation in Canada.
It's a recognition of their rights, which existed before colonization and now is being recognized within the Canadian Constitution.
Plus, the controversial bishop at the center of a terror attack in Sydney.
And in Barcelona, a bus route is disappearing from maps to give locals an edge over tourists. They take all the seats in the bus, says this elderly woman, but not anymore. That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thank you for joining us today. Weather is playing havoc in people's lives across the globe this week. In Central and South America, that has meant water shortages and calls to curb usage. In Bogota, Colombia, on Monday, the city's mayor went on national TV to tell residents to use less water, starting now.
Por eso hacemos un llamado para que la gente...
Mayor Carlos Fernando Galán told viewers to keep their showers down to 5 minutes. He also said, if you're not going out this weekend, wait until Monday to take a bath.
Aguanten hasta lunes. No se bañen.
The regional water shortage is affecting more than personal hygiene.
Hay un problema de lluvias bastante importante, no solo en Ecuador, sino también en Colombia.
Ecuadorian scholar Fernando Carrion told CNN that in his country, like Colombia, there is a significant rain problem, and that's led to the rationing of electricity. In other words, the El Niño weather pattern has depleted Ecuador's reservoirs, which in turn limited the output of hydroelectric plants, which produce about 75% of the nation's power, and workers have been asked to stay at home for the next 2 days. In Bolivia, the general manager of the Institute of Foreign Trade says farm production there is way down this year.
Gary Rodriguez went on satellite news service Telesur predicting shortages of wheat and corn in Bolivia that could lead to higher food prices, and he said the nation's much-needed revenue from soybean exports would fall.
De exportación solamente en el caso del sector soyero.
On the flip side, there is some good news. Scientists have said El Niño is transitioning to La Niña, which could mean some cooling temperatures. Still, drought conditions continue to affect the entire region from Mexico to Brazil, and no one seems ready to predict when that will end.
From drought in the Americas to deluge in the Gulf, this week Dubai and its neighbors were inundated with what some are calling a rain bomb. Heavy downpours drenched Dubai with more than 6 inches of precipitation in 24 hours. That is 2 years of rain in just one day. Greg Tanner has been out braving the storms. He heads the multimedia unit at the Abu Dhabi-based news outlet The National and is in Dubai.
The wind and the rain was absolutely lashing down. In fact, there was one point at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon where the cloud cover was so thick, it literally felt like nighttime. And then, you know, streets were flooded around me. I ventured out on a bike to take some video of my neighborhood. And I'd say there was like 12 inches of rainwater accumulated on a lot of streets.
Wow.
So, yes, it was fairly dramatic, yes.
I understood you made your way to the marina. What did that look like?
Yeah, so I live in a marina, and I came out of my building, and there were, you know, some of the sort of drainage systems were overflowing and literally gushing water out into the walkway around the marina. And then I headed down to an area called Jumeirah Beach Residence, which, you know, as the name suggests, is near a beach. And that's where, you know, around roundabouts in particular, literally there was 12 inches of water going way up onto the pavement. And I saw one taxi driver had parked his car all the way up on the sidewalk just to get it out the way of the road. So, yeah, it was interesting.
I know that the flooding canceled a lot of flights in Dubai. How did the airport handle all of this water on the runways?
Certainly, I saw video of the planes on the runway at Dubai Airport yesterday, and it looked like they were in rivers. Today, Emirates weren't accepting any check-ins from the morning, they say, until midnight tonight. But quite how they cleared the runway, I'm not sure.
So 2 years' worth of rain in one day would be, you know, a challenge for any city to deal with. But in Dubai, of course, you're not used to that much rain. So the buildings and stormwater infrastructure are not built to get rid of this kind of rain quickly, right?
Yeah, I mean, when it does rain heavily here, which obviously isn't very often, but it does happen a couple of times a year, then yes, arguably we're not as prepared as a lot of other countries and cities in the world. But I also would argue, the government said this morning that it was the worst rainfall that we've seen in the 75 years that they've been recording the stats. I'd argue that almost any city, whether in the States or the UK or Europe, if they had their worst day of rain for 75 years, it would bring their cities to a standstill.
Yeah, absolutely. The other factor is what happens when the rain hits the ground, and the sandy soil around where you are isn't very permeable. So that must add somewhat to the flooding, right?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, firstly, just the infrastructure isn't quite as up to par as it would be in a place that rains more often. But then also, yes, just the actual topography of the area and the sandiness and the desert nature means that there isn't soil that can absorb a lot of it. So it does stay on the surface. So it's kind of a bit of a twofold problem, one nature and one in the more design side of things.
More intense rains like this are expected to grow more frequent with climate change. I'm wondering if there are conversations happening around that topic today in Dubai.
Yes, there absolutely are. And actually, the UAE is sort of one of the nations leading the charge in terms of the conversation about climate change. You probably know they hosted the COP28 climate summit last year. So something like this is just a reminder of how important those conversations are.
Yeah. Of course, it is also a major fossil fuel producer, which is the trigger of climate change. Does that play into conversations at all?
Yeah, I think that adds to the responsibility that the UAE and other Gulf nations have of, you know, trying to do that little bit extra to compensate for the, you know, huge part of the economy that oil plays.
Mm-hmm. There have been controversial and contradictory comments about whether cloud seeding contributed to the flooding in Dubai. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, so the government categorically say that they were not cloud seeding on this one. I'd be surprised if they were, because if they cloud seeded this much and it flooded Oman and Iran, you know, which it did, this flooded a lot of other Gulf countries, then that would not go down very well. But that being said, cloud seeding definitely is a thing here.
I understand that the weather in Dubai is more pleasant today. Is there a longer term lesson that residents there are taking from this deluge?
I think one lesson that residents can learn is when the government tell you the weather's going to be bad here, please take them seriously, or you're going to be up, you know, one of the hundreds of cars that I've seen on social media stranded on Sheikh Zayed Road in 3 feet of water. But longer term, I think probably drainage systems could be improved here, honestly. But the argument has always been, well, it rains here so rarely, why would they make the investment? But I think, you know, if climate change is going to cause these things to happen more often and more severely, then that perhaps is another lesson that needs to be thought about.
There are those trade-offs to think about going forward. Do we prepare for events as they become more frequent, even if they're not all that frequent? Greg Tanner heads the multimedia unit at the Abu Dhabi-based news outlet The National. He joined us from Dubai. Thank you so much, Greg.
Thank you.
Pix, that's P-I-X, is shorthand for Brazil's instantaneous payment system. Over the past 3 years, the app has revolutionized how Brazilians pay for things. It's like sending a wire transfer through the banking app on your phone with no fees, but it's not a third-party app like Venmo or Cash App. From the southern Brazilian city of Florianopolis, Michael Fox reports on how Pix has changed many aspects of life for Brazilians.
I'm at a market downtown, buying a bag of loose tea. I open the banking app on my phone, click a few buttons, scan the QR code, and click send.
That's it, Pix enviado.
I've just sent my first Pix of the day. It was instantaneous, no cash, no credit cards, no fees. The money was sent straight from my bank account to the stores. A confirmation appears on my screen.
Olha, foi ótimo. Foi muito bom.
It's great, says Aguilar Stocco, who works at a local ice cream shop. I use Pix a lot, principally because you don't have to go to the bank or to the store to pay your bills and things. Now, she just pays it with a Pix from home. The Pix system was rolled out by Brazil's central bank in late 2020, in the middle of the pandemic. It's turned monetary exchange in Brazil upside down, with nearly 42 billion payments across the Brazilian economy last year. It's now the top way of making purchases or sending money in Brazil, far surpassing credit and debit card charges. And it is making cash nearly obsolete.
faz uns um ano,
21, né?
Eu parei de usar o uso só Pix.
Yeah, it's been more than a year since I used paper money, says Kelvin Cuadros Wink. He works at a local cell phone accessory store. He says his customers do use debit or credit cards, but most of the time, it's Pix. All ages are using Pix, he says. Everyone's adapted. Before it was money, now it's Pix. Well, maybe not everyone. Zilda Suarez works at a souvenir shop in the Florianópolis public market. She says the majority of her customers pay with Pix, but she's never jumped on board what she calls the Pix scam.
Na questão de eu não usar Pix porque pelo fato do número do CPF, porque ultimamente
I don't use Pix because you have to use your CPF, she says. That's like your Brazilian social security number. Lately everything's out there. There are hackers and people can get at your information. I don't need it, she says. But she is one of the few holdouts. Economist Daniel Vasconcelos says security is actually one of the reasons why the Pix system has been so successful. Pix has increased the circulation of money in the economy while decreasing concerns.
Nas maiores cidades, o problema crônico e clássico da violência urbana, assalto.
In many of Brazil's major cities, there is a chronic problem of urban violence, armed robbery, theft, that sort of thing, he says. Now, Pix created the possibility to go out and pay without having any money in your pocket. He says it has also benefited Brazilians in the countryside, where banks are few and far between.
Não tem agência bancária, ou agência que tenha muito pequena, não dá conta da dimensão do município.
We have regions that have relatively few banks, he says. Small municipalities, or areas where the town center is really far from where people live. And now they can do everything without having to travel. Vivian Machado sells kitchen towels on the street. Beside her lay piles of towels and a big colorful sign with the deal of the day and her Pix QR code. People use money. A lot more use Pix, she says. But sometimes people don't want to use it, or they can't, if their cell phones run out of battery or they don't have enough data. One group that's been left out of the Pix revolution, the homeless. Mauricio Suarez wears a worn brown backpack. He came to the state capital in search of work. It didn't pan out. I'm sleeping on the street there, he says. I'm trying to find some money to get a bite to eat. It's not easy. See, Pix means people have less cash or change in their pockets. They could send him money via Pix. But in order to receive it, Suarez would need a bank account and a cell phone with data, something he does not have. But he is a minority in a system that has taken over the country. And Brazil's Pix is inspiring some of its neighbors to follow suit. At least half a dozen other Latin American nations have rolled out some form of an instant payment system in recent years. Brazilian tourists can now also use Pix in neighboring Uruguay and Argentina. It's a sign of the things to come, in a future world with a lot more cell phones and a lot less cash. For The World, I'm Michael Fox. Florianópolis, Brazil.
Think about if you're traveling in a new city. You pull up your favorite map app on your phone to figure out how you're going to get where you're going next. But in Barcelona, there is a catch.
Just ahead, we'll explain how big tech and local commuters have joined forces to rig the transit maps in Barcelona. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Spain saw a record number of tourists last year, more than 85 million. Good for the economy, but a hassle for some Spaniards, like locals who live around Barcelona's famous Parc Güell. It's at the top of a steep hill, and residents depend on a small bus to get up and down. And these days, the seats are mostly filled by tourists. So the city is trying to help the locals with an interesting solution. It got the bus route erased from Google and Apple Maps, as we hear from The World's Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Parc Güell's bus, number 116, has gone dark. And guess what? The cloaking effect is working, at least on me.
Well, I'm Googling the 116 bus, but obviously it's not coming up in my searches, so I can't even find it.
I've been driving around in my car this morning near Parc Güell.
I'm afraid to roll down my window and ask somebody, hey, you know where the 116 bus is? They're just going to think I'm another tourist. Throw lettuce at me.
I eventually find the bus stop. It's at the base of the hill below the park. And waiting there alone are locals Marga, Luisa, and Conchita. They didn't want to give their last names.
Los aquí del barrio tenemos estas cuestas que hay muchas personas mayores como yo.
We have to get up and down this hill, says Conchita. She's got red coiffed hair and holds a cane and a grocery bag. Many of us are elderly, she says, but often the bus doesn't even stop because it's already full. Full of tourists. But no longer, it would appear. The 116 pulls up, stops, and lets us on. This is a neighborhood bus, really more of a shuttle. It can carry around 25 people. I asked the driver, are you noticing less tourists now that the 116 is off the maps? Yeah, there are fewer, he says, gunning the bus up a steep, winding lane. But I'm driving, he says, pointing to a sign that says, don't talk to the driver. I can't comment, he says, while working. At my stop, several older riders quibble over who should help who down to the sidewalk. And then, there it is, the entrance to Parkway. I think I'll go in, talk to some tourists. There are already hundreds inside. But it's sold out at 10 a.m. on a random Wednesday in April. The park was designed by Antoni Gaudí, Barcelona's modernist master. It was supposed to be a community of individual homes with views of the sea, but his concept was ahead of its time. Gaudí ended up living there alone. Today, more than a century later, you need a reservation just to take a gander. As I stare at the sold-out sign at the park's entrance, an out-of-breath tourist walks over. His name is Jay Kwa. He and I shrug with mutual disappointment.
Did you come from far away to see this?
Me?
Yeah.
United States.
Where in the United States?
Washington, D.C.
I thought I could get in also, and it says the next available tickets are Friday night.
Oh, Friday night.
Will you come back?
I'll come back tomorrow. Come back?
Yeah. Tomorrow?
Yeah.
No tickets tomorrow. All sold out.
Oh. 40 minutes walking.
There's a bus you can take.
Eh?
There's a bus you can take, not the 116. Take the other one.
There is another bus that gets you close to the park, a big normal city bus. I'm glad to steer tourists in that direction. It's hard to say whether hiding the little 116 is keeping tourists away from the park, but at the bus stop below, the local women tell me that isn't the point. I came down to go to the bank, says Marga. I came down to buy bread and groceries, says Luisa. I can't pull the shopping trolley all the way back up the hill. It's too heavy. What these women want and what they've gotten with the help of Google and Apple is their bus back and a way just to get home in peace. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Police are calling a recent knife attack at a church in Sydney, Australia, an act of terror. An assailant on Monday stabbed a bishop, priest, and members at an Assyrian church where many congregants are Christians from Iraq and Syria. The victim's injuries were not life-threatening. This incident came shortly after six people were stabbed to death in a Sydney mall. Police say it was unrelated. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney.
Bishop Marmari Emmanuel was delivering his sermon from his church in Western Sydney when a teenager walked up to the altar. The service was being live-streamed for the bishop's many followers on social media. In a video that has now been widely circulated online, the attacker, dressed in black, lunges at the clergyman and stabs him over and over again in the head and chest. Police arrested a 16-year-old at the scene, but they had to hold him at the church for his own safety. Angry crowds had gathered outside, demanding that the attacker be handed over to them. They're shouting, "Bring him out," and "an eye for an eye."
Get back!
The crowd smashed cars and were throwing bricks and chunks of concrete at police officers. Paramedics were holed up in the church for more than 3 hours, too afraid to come out. Officials say four people were injured in the attack: Bishop Emmanuel, a priest, and two congregants who had tried to intervene and got stabbed in the process. None of the injuries were life-threatening. In a briefing the next morning, New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb said the church stabbing was a case of religious extremism.
After consideration of all the material, I declared that it was a terrorist incident.
Webb said she'd seen a video where the attacker was making comments about religion, but didn't give any other details. The Guardian newspaper and Reuters are reporting that there's a separate video recorded after the attack where members of the congregation are pinning the boy down, and he says in Arabic, "If they didn't insult my prophet, I wouldn't have come here." Beyond that, the police haven't revealed much about the attacker. But the victim, Bishop Marmari Emanuel, is a controversial figure. He's the head of a breakaway Assyrian Orthodox Church, which is a Christian minority that hails from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. In 2021, Emanuel became well known for his pandemic skepticism. In a sermon that had hundreds of thousands of views online, he slammed the Australian government's strict COVID-19 lockdowns.
Are we humans or are we animals? Because we are treated like animals. This is an absolute mass slavery.
Since then, he has built up a worldwide following for sermons that claim the United Nations was started by Satan and that trans people shouldn't be considered human. But it's his comments about the Prophet Muhammad, made in a podcast in the U.S. late last year, that's getting most of the media attention right now in the aftermath of Monday's attack.
Your prophet failed those laws. Your own prophet failed them.
Who?
Muhammad. And the very reason why Muhammad failed, because he's dead.
Today in Sydney, the Muslim community remains on high alert. Mosques are beefing up security after reports of bomb threats and text messages urging Assyrian Christians to retaliate. Faith leaders, meanwhile, held an emergency meeting in the middle of the night on Monday. In the end, they released a joint statement. "We condemn violence in any form," they wrote. "We're calling on everyone to act with kindness and respect for each other." For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
You're listening to The World.
Honduran tap dancer Gerson Lanza found he could communicate well through his feet.
I really found refuge in tap dancing, like literally. Like, you know how often people say, art is a form of communication.
And there's anger on the streets of the Republic of Georgia over a controversial proposed law that many feel is similar to one in Russia. All that and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. An historic agreement has been struck in British Columbia. The provincial government has turned over title rights of Aboriginal land to the Haida Nation, a First Nations community there. It is a big deal. Governance of land will transfer from the Crown to the Haida Nation. The land in question is almost 2,000 square miles of Haida Gwaii, an archipelago of islands off the far north coast of British Columbia. The agreement came about through negotiation, not the courts. Louise Mandel is a lawyer who specializes in Aboriginal rights. She's worked with the Haida for 40 years and was involved in coming up with this new agreement. We reached her in Vancouver.
What the Haida and BC do with this agreement is finally to address the core injustice that's plagued Crown Indigenous relations since the beginning of colonization. So when the settlers arrived, Crown law was not followed. The governments were required to recognize the prior occupation of Indigenous people to their territories as legal rights. But this didn't happen in BC. The land was simply stolen. So it's really the first of its kind negotiated agreement where the province of BC recognizes Haida Aboriginal title throughout the land on Haida Gwaii. But here the recognition by the Crown shifts the ownership and jurisdiction of the land from the Crown to the Haida Nation and Crown law.
This would seem to be a really important moment in terms of case law. Why is this agreement important from a legal point of view?
Well, it's important for so many reasons. I'd say that the most significant part of it is that now Haida law, this beautiful ancient laws of respect and reciprocity and humility, Haida law is going to have room now to steward Haida Gwaii. So this is laws which were deliberately erased from the landscape, are now going to be put back on the landscape and are going to be able to steward not just the land, but the human use of the land.
Yeah, practically, what does that mean that the Haida have human use of the land?
Well, practically, there's going to be a transition period for the reconciliation reconciliation of Haida and BC laws and jurisdiction. And meanwhile, the Haida have been respectful and inclusive of everyone's interests on Haida Gwaii. There's no change to non-Haida local governments. There's no change to the delivery of public services on Haida Gwaii. So all the respective existing interests have a place in the agreement. But what will change is that the Haida's laws and how they will decide how the land will be used and how the land will be taken care of, this over time will shift into becoming Haida jurisdiction. And then that will determine how the human use of the land is made.
The Haida is one First Nations community, but how do you see the future, Louise? Could this set a precedent for more agreements like this by other First Nations communities in British Columbia and even elsewhere in Canada?
Yeah. Well, you know, when Roger Bannister broke the four-minute mile, it was next broken in 45 days. Like, once one person does something new, it becomes doable. So the Haida and BC have negotiated a recognition of Haida title throughout their territory. It's not going to be the same as in other territories, but the formula of the government recognizing title and then the Indigenous nation working with the government to make sure that their laws are reasserted on the landscape, to recognize respectfully the interests of others who live in their territory, that is what this agreement does, and that's what can be done throughout the rest of BC, throughout the rest of Canada, perhaps throughout the rest of the Commonwealth world.
So the land, the Haida Gwaii, tell us more about the community and the land.
It's an exquisite archipelago. The land and water are very interconnected. And the people of Haida Gwaii have made Haida Gwaii their home for many, many, many thousands of years, millennia. There's two main villages in Skidigut and Masset. It's a fish-dependent, forest-dependent community. It's an ancient rainforest. It's hard for me to describe it because it's such a rich, incredibly beautiful area where the forest and the fisheries are such an intertwined community of living beings.
What has been the reaction among people you know in the Haida Nation, your friends, people you've worked with?
You know, that's an interesting question. When the Haida Nation House of Assembly ratified the agreement, this was with a 95% vote in favor in the village of Old Massa, there was a spontaneous eruption of collective joy, just drumming and dancing, singing, tears. It was very emotional. And I witnessed the positioning of pleasure and justice. When something feels deeply right, when people feel respected, there's such a pleasurable, joyful uprising, which happened when the agreement was ratified. And you can feel that joy. It was a signing ceremony last weekend, and the room was just filled with this otherworldly, gorgeous feeling of accomplishment.
Were you there for that?
Yeah, I was. It was pretty amazing.
For you, what was the part that really stood out?
Well, it was that collective explosion of joy and that collective explosion of accomplishment and that collective explosion of respect. That was something which will remain in my heart forever. It was just beautiful to feel.
Louise Mandel is a Vancouver-based lawyer who worked with the Haida for 40 years and advised them on this new land title agreement.
Protesters took to the streets of Georgia's capital, Tbilisi, again today. Demonstrators are angry about a proposed foreign agent law that is working its way through parliament there. Many compare it to legislation in Russia and worry it may jeopardize Georgia's bid to join the European Union. For more, we turn to Gheorghe Lomsatsa, a longtime Georgian journalist based in Tbilisi.
Under this law, all news organizations and nonprofit groups that source more than 20% of their funding from abroad will have to register as agents of foreign influence. You have to understand that in this country, all quality news outlets get funding from international donors. And the same goes for the watchdog groups that monitor elections, corruption in the government, that work on minority rights. So putting it simply, everyone that may criticize government will have to register as foreign agents. If they refuse to comply, they will face significant fines.
Just how similar is this law to what is already in effect in Russia and also Azerbaijan?
For now, it is not as punitive. At this stage, it's demonizing these organizations rather than silencing them. But we saw it was a very similar situation in Russia, and that's why everyone is really worried. But at first, these organizations and news outlets, they all only had to register as foreign agents, and that didn't mean that they couldn't continue operating. But over time, it got expanded, its scope got expanded, and eventually, you barely have anyone who can say anything about the government without serious implications.
So what is Georgia's ruling party's argument for trying to pass this law in parliament?
The ruling party's argument that it's all about transparency, that they claim that all groups that get international funding, on all non-governmental groups and media, be held to the same standard as our government agencies, the same standard of transparency. It's just unclear that why would you need to register as an agent of foreign influence if it's about transparency. It could be a law setting new rules of disclosing funding publicly. You don't have to register as a foreign agent for that. And so the government here is trying to cite examples from other countries, like the United States, or the law that you have there, or in European Union countries. But there are key differences between this law and the Western laws that are comparable, and similarities with the Russian law.
So I'm curious, if the law does pass the parliament, would that impact where Georgia sits, kind of geopolitically speaking?
Oh, absolutely. Formally, Georgia wants to join European Union, and most of Georgia's population fervently wants that. Georgia has been working very hard to be considered a member, and formally, Georgian government says that they all want the same thing. But to integrate with the European Union, Georgia needs to improve its democracy and meet some certain criteria that European Union offered. Now the European Union says that this law is incompatible with European regulations. And this means that Georgia may be doing this about face. And the worry here is that if Georgia moves away from the European Union, the only big power of influence that's left around here is Russia.
And how do Georgians feel these days about Russia and about Russians?
Majority of Georgians see the country, Putin's regime, is seen as an enemy state. This is why lots of people here in Georgia, they call this new law a Russian law. And not just because of similarities with Russian law, but because they feel that that's the implication. If we pass the law, this law, if it gets adopted, Georgia will be moving away from the West and the European Union and making alliance with Russia.
What is the status of this law? Is there a vote in parliament scheduled?
It was adopted in first reading today. There will be two more readings. It means that there will be some questions, discussions, and then in some time it will be returned. The third hearing, it will be written into a law. So tonight, there already is a big demonstration, and even more people are gathering in front of the parliament to protest.
Georgi Lamsatsa is a longtime Georgian journalist. He joined us from Tbilisi.
And now a few updates for you from the war in Ukraine.
Three Russian missiles slammed into the city center of Chernihiv this morning near the border with Belarus. An apartment building was hit, killing at least 17 people and injuring dozens more, according to authorities.
Later in the day today, two top Pentagon officials told lawmakers that Russia is gaining the upper hand in the war in Ukraine. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General C.Q. Brown testified to the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. Brown told lawmakers bluntly, Ukraine is being outmatched by the Russian forces.
And late this afternoon, there was a little movement on the question of U.S. financial support for Ukraine's war effort. President Biden said he strongly supports a proposal from House Speaker Mike Johnson that would provide $95 billion in aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. That vote in Congress could come this weekend.
You can find our extensive coverage on the war in Ukraine at our website, theworld.org. and wherever you listen to podcasts. A year ago, rivalry between military generals in Sudan exploded into a full-blown civil war that has now spiraled into one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. This week, international donors pledged more than $2 billion in aid to help the people impacted by the crisis. Millions of Sudanese have fled to countries in the region, including Kenya. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi in Nairobi spoke with some of them about this war.
At a gallery in Nairobi, Kenya, a group of Sudanese artists take turns painting strokes onto a mural that's commemorating the year-long civil war in their home country. 62-year-old artist and curator Issam Hafez explains the images of displacement, death, and destruction.
There is Sudanese, like homes, like villages, like people died.
Hafez, who escaped Sudan last year, tells me that he thought this war would only last for 1 or 2 weeks.
Now we are completing 1 year and the war is still going on, and people are suffering from many things: lack of medicine, lack of water, lack of home.
For Hafez and many other Sudanese, this war has been a shocking turn of events. Since 2019, their country had been on a difficult but inspiring path towards democracy. It was during this hopeful time that Dr. El-Shafi Mohamed Ahmed decided to return to Sudan after nearly 20 years living abroad.
We saw an opportunity for real development, to make some difference on the ground. And we saw an opportunity to change our world first and then contribute to.
Ahmed decided to open up several farms in order to employ dozens of people. He tells me on the day the war began, on April 15th, he was meant to open yet another one, along with his cousin. That morning, he heard shooting and bombardment in Khartoum. He told his cousin not to travel to meet him.
Next day, he tried to come again, and he got shot at. And he got shot dead. He was 34 years old. So from a day where we were very hopeful to start a new farm and work there, it ended up with him being killed.
Ahmed had been displaced twice by this war and has seen how people have had to rely on their families, communities, and the goodwill of strangers to survive. As a doctor who has spent around 20 years working for international aid organizations, what hurts him the most is a lack of medical care.
I have family members who died because of lacking basic health care. I have family members now who got their hands or feet amputated because they did not have insulin to control their diabetes.
Ahmed and many of the Sudanese people I speak with say this war has been forgotten by the rest of the world. International organizations, Ahmed says, are not doing enough to help people in Sudan.
I mean, I don't care how much obstacles both warring parties are imposing. I still think that they can do something. I have seen some NGOs doing something. So I believe others can do, but they chose not to.
Those left behind are on the mind of 28-year-old activist Mona Malik Al-Zubir. While she was able to escape to Kenya, Azibir tells me much of her family remains stuck in Darfur.
In the morning, I speak with them, and they say to me that they're still alive, but their situation is not very safe, or there is no protection for them because, as you know, RSF control over all of Al-Janina.
She tells me people in Darfur are facing bombardment, indiscriminate killing of civilians, sexual violence against women, and ethnic violence reminiscent of the genocide in Darfur 20 years ago. Azibir tells me all of this makes her question whether Sudan will be able to return to its democratic aspirations.
I want Sudan to have peace, have democracy, have civilian governance, but there is no indicator for that. I afraid from my future. What can I do? Where I will be?
Her hopes right now lie in the anticipated mediation talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. She hopes it could at least lead to a ceasefire. Later on in the day, a singer takes to the stage to perform traditional songs from all over Sudan, including from Darfur. For Al-Zubir, the familiar sound brings back memories of the time before the war. Here, surrounded by people from all different parts of Sudan, Al-Jabir says she begins to feel some hope.
And after that, after all, I heard the music, Sudanese music. It also let me feel like I have people. They will support me and I will support other people. And we together will be strong. And after that, we can bring peace.
For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Nairobi.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Art is communication. We paint, dance, or play music to express ourselves. Tap dancing obviously fits the bill. Today on Movement, our series about music and migration, Macleet Hedero speaks with tap dancer Gerson Lanza about the long journey he took to find his voice in his feet. It's a journey that began in Honduras.
When you were a kid growing up in Honduras, what did you know about tap dancing?
Absolutely nothing.
Really?
Tap dance was never in the picture.
Tap dance entered Gerson's life through three encounters. First on television.
At the time, it was one of those big monster TVs that looked like furniture.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and my mom had sent that TV from the U.S. because she was already living in the United States. Nonetheless, my dad and I sat down in front of that TV and turned on Sesame Street. Sunny day, sleeping up, and in one of these episodes, I first encounter tap dance through Gregory Hines and Maurice Hines.
Today, my brother and I are going to be talking about near and far.
And I saw their feet move so fast, and I'm like, how can they make all of these sounds and their body is not moving as fast as their sounds are hitting my ear? What's happening?
Like a superpower.
Yeah, it's exactly what it was. It was a superpower.
I don't know what you're doing.
The second encounter with tap dance was, are you familiar with the Apollo Theater in Harlem?
Am I familiar with it?
I'm not surprised. Well, then you are also familiar with Amateur Night at the Apollo, which happens every Wednesday.
Yes.
And they've been doing this for decades and decades. Well, again, reruns in Honduras.
It's time for Amateur Night with Mark Curry.
I was again in my living room with my dad, and Amateur Night at the Apollo is famous for booing people off stage.
Yes, it is. It's high pressure.
It's high pressure. You either bring it correct or you're going to get booed off stage very, very quickly. Well, what happens when you get booed off stage? The Sandman comes out. And the Sandman has always been a tap dancer.
Oh, yes.
And I remember he jumped off the balcony onto the stage and started doing these amazing rhythms as he's, like, moving the unwanted talent from stage. And the crowd goes crazy while he's on stage doing his thing, right?
All right, coming up next.
That was the second time I encountered tap dancing. And again, it was like this glorious moment. Of course, not for the performer on stage, but for me. Watching from the distance, from Honduras to be exact, this was one of the most entertaining things that I've ever seen.
How old are you in this moment?
At this time, I was probably 9 years old, 9 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got to tell you about the third time I actually saw tap dancing.
In person.
In person. I'm now 11, and I'm in the United States, and I'm going to Whatley Secondary School for the Performing and Visual Arts in New York City.
Mm.
Well, it happens that when I walked into the dance class, the person that walked in to teach that class is the very same Sandman from the Apollo that I watched from my living room in Honduras. It brought a sense of calmness, because I was familiar with the Sandman. I was familiar with the environment that he was in.
And it was a thread. It was like a thread of continuity that you could hold.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm also thinking of the way that when you have a migration experience and you don't know the language, suddenly you're also given and you yourself are putting energy into cultivating a skill where you can communicate your very essence and being, even without words.
Totally. I really found refuge in tap dancing, like literally. Like, you know how often people say, yo, you know, yeah, art is a form of communication. For to me, that was it. I couldn't speak English, right? Like there was no preparation for my coming to the United States, not for me or my brothers. And so for me, truly, tap dancing was the form, because you could communicate so much through tap dancing. You know, you can hit hard, you can hit soft, you can find different tonalities in your tap shoes. There's a lot that can be said with tap dancing. Yes. And for me, it was truly that.
That's Gerson Lanza tap dancing at the Kennedy Center. You can find more stories about music and migration on Movement with Macleet Hedero. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. The series is produced by Macleet and Ian Koss with support from the National Geographic Society and the Mellon Foundation.
Before we say goodbye today, we wanted to introduce you to Emerson the Elephant Seal, who just cannot seem to quit the community of Oak Bay in British Columbia. The 500-pound beast returned recently after the fourth unsuccessful attempt by officials to relocate him to a new home way offshore. He had swum back 90 miles to his favorite beach in Oak Bay at a pretty fast clip.
Fishery officer Morgan Van Kirk told the CBC that Emerson's navigation skills and tenacity are awe-inspiring. They are also a safety problem, he said, for the animal and the community.
We were getting multiple reports of people trying to pet him. In one more egregious incident, it was reported that somebody with their small child was getting them to go up and touch their nose to the seals.
Emerson, the elephant seal, has also ventured off his favorite beach and cross roads into busy parts of town.
For now, the Fisheries Department is warning the public of steep fines for harassing marine mammals, and they're keeping an eye on Emerson himself. They say if the situation gets worse, they'll take a fifth run at relocating him.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.